Hello again, and welcome back to the Ostrich Technique podcast. I'd say this is the episode where you can bury your head in the sand, but in this episode, I guess you can bury your head inside a giant celestial head. I'm Nanth, one of your hosts.
And I am Chris.
Yeah, Chris, I know you were excited about this episode, just like I was excited about last one.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably my number one or close to it at this point.
Was
my number one for a while in the MCU. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, very excited for this one.
Yes. And of course, this one being Guardians of the Galaxy, pretty out there movie for Marvel at the time. I mean, I know that there was a lot of talk about how this was really their sort of big swing. I mean, everything was very traditional and like they were very much sticking to like the standard superhero trope. Obviously, Winter Soldier was a little bit different, but this was really their big swing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it worked for all intents and purposes.
It did.
It is considered one of the best MCU movies, I think, pretty unanimously. So, yeah. And I mean, just rewatching it, the tone is so different. And like the style that this movie has is so different than every other MCU movie. And it really levels up sort of the entire aesthetic of the MCU, I think, overall, compared to some of the other stuff that they'd been putting out.
Yeah, I agree. It's really the space opera. And
yeah.
James Gunn does not shy away from making it all wonky and colorful, and it pays off.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, we can even talk about this as we get into it, but like even the meta context that was like behind this movie as well, about like him actually making this movie, also I think makes this very interesting overall, and we can discuss that as we get into the movie. But it's just a really well-made movie overall. Mm. Top to bottom, like the acting is great. And this is a movie that really highlights, I think, again, one of those things we were talking about in our What's Going Wrong with the MCU episode right now, is that this really has such a strong focus on the characters. And like right away, you're immediately endeared to everyone just because there's such strong characterization. And part of the reason why I would say Guardians 3 is really one of the few successful later phase MCU movies.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, but let's not, I mean, there's a lot to discuss here, so let's not waste any more time and let's just get right into it, Chris. Why don't you give us the rundown on this movie?
Sure. Guardians of the Galaxy, Retroactively, Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by James Gunn. It is about a group of intergalactic criminals who must pull together to stop a fanatical warrior with plans to purge the universe. It stars Chris Pratt, Vin Diesel, Bradley Cooper, Karen Gillan, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, and Lee Pace. So
yep.
a really, you know, ensemble cast.
It is very much an ensemble. And they lean on the fact that it's an ensemble. I mean, like, kind of like the Avengers almost, where the movie works because of the interactions and chemistry that the cast has with one another. So it's, I mean, just top to bottom, that's really great. So, I mean, we can start off right here from Act 1, and we can sort of keep this kind of like how we tried to do with the Cap episode last week, where we can just sort of talk about our favorite bits from Act 1. So, Chris, I'll let you lead, since this is really your favorite movie. So what are maybe some favorite scenes of yours from Act 1, things that stuck out to you?
Honestly, the Come and Get Your Love opening.
Of course. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's just so fun. It's iconic.
Yeah.
I just love that opening. I think it's a perfect opening, in my opinion. It's
yeah,
a really great way for us to get to know Star-Lord's personality without him saying a word.
Yeah.
And this movie does a great job of incorporating the soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
probably more so than any other franchise in the
MCU. Yeah.
And right off the bat, we get that infusion of the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, this movie starts off really unlike any other MCU movie, which is, I think, what makes it so unique. That's one of the scenes that I also had listed, is just, it's absolutely iconic. You know, him just sort of dancing around on Morag and singing Come and Get Your Love. It really just hits. I mean, it just puts a smile on your face, really. And I think that that's mm-hmm. really part of the charm of this movie, is that it really does just put a smile on your face. And it, even with all of the seriousness it's just such a fun movie. And James Gunn really has a way of pulling out that sense of fun, even in the more serious moments. And it's balanced really well, unlike maybe some later movies like Love and Thunder, where it gets, I think, a bit too much.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
What about you?
Another scene that stuck out to me. You know, I think, honestly, even the beginning scene where, like, young Peter Quill is in the hospital listening to his Walkman with his mom. I mean, even before the come and get your love scene, you can all, I think just from that scene alone, you can really tell that it's going to be a lot more emotionally driven as a movie overall. I feel like a lot of the other MCU movies where you start off with something, it's like either starting off with some like plot device or, and I mean, you know, this is part of the plot as well, but it's plot that very much is rooted in developing the character of Peter Quill. And obviously with Meredith Quill dying in the beginning, it really sets the tone that like throughout even all of this fun, there's like a sort of an underpinning of sadness that really is driving Peter Quill, and also kind of regret, the fact that he never took his mom's hand just as she was just on her deathbed, basically.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, we go back to this character development, these character moments.
Yeah.
And that really is a great example of that, and really getting to humanize some of these characters, especially in something like this where it's mainly in space. It's a great way to really start off the film and get to empathize or sympathize with the characters even more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very different note for the MCU overall. Like, it's a lot more, I think, serious than I think the MCU's ever gotten. And the same holds true once we even get to like Guardians 3, like the maybe one of the darkest MCU films, seriously, overall, just with all the stuff they deal with Rocket in that one. And James Gunn is never afraid to go there. How about you, Chris? I'll pass it back to you. Another scene.
Sure. I think the escape from the kiln, the prison that they are held at, is okay. A really fun scene or sequence as well. We get to really see, one, them incite a prison fight, but two, you get to see Rocket's ingenuity and genius of basically hot wiring the systems to undo the artificial gravity.
Yeah.
And, you know, him actually like directing all of the different guardians or future guardians, I guess, of what they need to go get to help him pull off this plan. And we get an iconic shot of Rocket going on top of Groot as he's shooting his guns. So that was a really fun scene. And it was like the first time where the guardians actually sort of work together for the first time.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, it's another good scene because I was going to say that that's like the first scene where we really get the guardians almost kind of being the guardians together. Obviously, they're not acting altruistically here. They're acting out of really their own individual self-interests. But even then, it's still great. And it's really typified by the fact that when the music comes, it is the first time that we actually hear the guardians theme when they're about to bust into the sort of guard tower there. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned Rocket, but really everyone gets like their own little character moments here that really sort of cement why they're great. I mean, we get Drax. I mean, he's just sort of along for the ride. I think that's sort of his vibe throughout all of the movies, that he's just sort of there and having a fun time really when he can. But he's obviously in the first movie or so really driven by his goal of trying to stop Ronan or like get back at Ronan for killing his family. Obviously, Peter has his moment where he's trying to ask the guy for his prosthetic leg, which is also quite funny. Groot and Rocket have their, I mean, you mentioned Rocket being, you know, a great, he has this intelligence about him, but he finds this glee in, you know, just killing things or like just shooting his gun. Groot very much just kind of being the lovable oaf, really, the lovable muscle when he takes out the Kornix battery right in the beginning. And then Gamora also obviously being a very skilled fighter to get the arm controller thing. So we really get like all of these like moments from each other. And even like beforehand in the kiln, we get a lot of these sort of interactions between them and moments that highlight their character. Like even when Gamora, like they first entered a prison and everyone is really taunting Gamora because, you know, she is the daughter of Thanos and has really done a lot of his deeds for him. Despite her stoicism, she really does have, like, you can sense that there's fear there. And that's sort of the driving, I guess, motivation for her to also want to get out of the kiln as well. But yeah, prison scene's a great scene. Really shows them working together. Though at this point, they aren't really the Guardians yet, but they are working together, like I guess they will later on. But yeah, great, great call there, Chris. I'm going to jump in and say, I mean, this is not really a scene, but really all of the stuff. I mean, the whole chase sequence in Xandar and then them getting arrested was also, I think, a great way to introduce them. And I mean, the setup was also really smart. Like, we have this MacGuffin of the orb, really. And I would say it's maybe one of the more meaningful MacGuffins that we've had because it actually does something and has meaning in this movie, it being an Infinity Stone and all. But the way that everyone is sort of converging on trying to get either the orb or to get Peter really leads to that sort of great three-way fight on Xandar between Rocket and Groot versus Peter versus Gamora. And that you also start getting a sense of, you know, their characters and how they sort of deal with things in that whole fight scene. And Xandar obviously also very different and very colorful and bright versus the sort of dark space aesthetic that we get throughout this movie.
For sure.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I know that that whole scene of at the when they're arrested by the Nova Corps and they have the little screens come up and they're introducing them, just a really smart way of introducing completely different characters that the audience probably has never heard of. I mean, these were... I mean, people forget these were real deep cut, like not even comic book fans had really heard of the Guardians of the Galaxy. And it's just a really smart way to introduce them. And it had so many Easter eggs in there, too. I mean,
they did,
all
yeah.
of the. Yeah. Like, I mean, Rocket having being mentioned as like having his associates being like Lila, for example. Gamora being listed as the last of her species, basically.
Well, and that one is, you know, that one's up to debate, given what Thanos says later on. And was it Infinity War? But anyway.
Sorry, yeah, continue. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's up for debate, but I think it's also not because I think Gamora does say that like her people basically didn't survive after that whole, you know, culling. But anyway, I'm neither here nor there. But right now, I mean, yeah, it really a lot of cool little Easter eggs that pop up there. And again, it's another way to demonstrate character in the whole thing where Peter is still sort of like mocking the whole process, like as he, you know, flips them off.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anything you want to add to the whole Xandar scene here?
No, I think you covered it. Again, I think this first act is littered with really great scenes.
Yeah. I mean, the entire movie is really littered with great scenes. So we could just keep going on and on here. Another thing that I want to talk about, it isn't really a scene, but just more generally, is the notion that James Gunn was really the czar of Marvel Celestial. And you can really tell that he has really put a stamp on the sort of visual aesthetic and the sort of style of space within the MCU, even after he was gone, really. Like, the style that James Gunn really brought to it was, I think, very unique and really made this feel very fleshed out. And a part of it being also like he really takes, I think, a cue from Star Wars, where Star Wars would do this like really great thing of just showing you little bits and pieces of what's going on in this broader world and not necessarily explain every single thing and really leave it up to the viewer's imagination. And I think that that works very much in the favor of Guardians, because there's so, I mean, we've really been very terrestrially focused in the first sort of set of MCU movies, really, even up till Winter Soldier. I mean, Avengers has a bit of, you know, space mumbo jumbo. I mean, with like
Thor as well, but
Thor, yeah, you deal with some more sort of fantastical stuff, but it's still been like relatively grounded, and this is really where they sort of swing for it with like all of the celestial stuff and stuff going on in space. Like, we see a lot of different planets. We see like actually very different like alien creatures and stuff. Yeah, it's just great. I mean, he really set a strong foundation, and it's, I mean, great for DC that James Gunn is there now, because I trust his sort of world building sensibilities, but it is a shame that the MCU lost someone as, you know, honestly visionary as James Gunn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other final scenes here for you, Chris, in Act One as we wrap up?
No, I think we're good to wrap up unless there's any final scene you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the beginning, it's not really a scene, but it's sort of like a common thread in the movie is the importance of Quill's Walkman and how, you know, when they get arrested, he gets really personally upset when the guard is listening to the music and literally risks getting beaten up or, I guess in this case, electrocuted for that thing. And then at the end, when they're escaping the prison or the kiln, rather, he is, again, willing to sacrifice being left behind to save that Walkman again. At this point in the movie, we don't really understand why it's so important to him other than it being very important. And I think what makes it funnier is how trivial it seems to everyone else. I mean, when he gets it back and he comes back on the Milano at the end of the prison break, he hands what he was, you know, fighting for to Drax. And then Drax just looks at it and says, "You're an imbecile." And I mean, that always gets a laugh from me, but like, you can see from Drax's perspective, it seems completely stupid, but for Quill, it's more than just a Walkman. It's obviously a connection to his mom, which we get an understanding of later on. But it's just littered with character moments. I mean, every scene just really helps establish such a great sense of character here. But yeah, I guess you had nothing else to add there, Chris?
No. I think we're good to move on to the cameos.
Yeah. And this is it's actually the first time in a while I think we've done a Stan Lee cameo between Act 1 and 2, just because he always seems to pop up later in these movies. But yes, we are going to do a Stan Lee cameo now. So this one is, of course, Stan Lee flirting with a younger woman on Xandar. We don't hear him say anything, but we just get a visual of him and, you know, Rocket giving his sort of flavor to what's going on there. But Chris, what do you think of this cameo?
I thought it was all right. Uh-huh. I don't think it was anything that was super, you know, blew me away, but also wasn't like super underwhelming to me. So I put it like somewhere in the middle. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Somewhere in the middle. Yeah. I mean, I think this one it has its moment. Like, it's funny. I mean, I think it just does what it needs to, is that at this point, like, it's become a very much a standard. Like, it just gives you a little bit of a pop in the theater or when you're watching the movie, but it doesn't have like any, I don't know. It doesn't hit with me the same as like maybe some of the other ones. I mean, I'm looking back at the list here. I don't even remember what his Iron Man 3 cameo was anymore.
It was the beauty pageant.
Right. It was the beauty pageant judge. Right. So I would say, honestly, I would put this actually towards the bottom, honestly.
Yeah, I put this between as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd probably put this as between like Iron Man 3 and Iron Man 2. So I guess that would put it as number 8 now for me. And then my list would be Thor 2, Cap 2, Thor, Cap 1, Iron Man 1, The Avengers, Iron Man 3, now Guardians, Iron Man 2, and Incredible Hulk.
I think I'm going to put this in my 8th spot.
Okay, so around the same, basically the same spot.
Yeah. So that'll be between Thor and the Avengers for me.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So that is, and now we have, that makes sense. So kind of underwhelming little cameo there, but you can't really knock a Stan Lee cameo, but yeah, and just as an update for our viewers, because, you know, 10, we're getting a little bit unwieldy here with these sort of Stan Lee rankings here. I mean, I think we also have a harder time keeping track of where all of this goes. So next, for our Super Size Avengers episode, we'll be re-ranking these into sort of tiers, you know, the standard S, A, B, C, F tier or whatever. So yeah, hopefully that'll make it a little bit easier, and we'll, you know, publish the list somewhere so you guys can sort of follow along with us. But yeah, that's, I think, our Stan Lee cameos. But I guess we can just jump right into Act 2 then, Chris.
Yeah, let's get into Act 2.
Yeah. And why don't you start us off again? Act 2 is chock-a-block. There's a lot of stuff going on in Act 2. So What are some things that stuck out to you here?
It's a good question. I don't know. I'm going to be honest. I liked Act One more.
Okay.
But maybe the collector scene.
Mm-hmm.
One, we're getting more lore on the Infinity Stones.
Yes.
We get to actually see the power of what's been inside this orb that we've been introduced to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we get introduced to the collector in a greater capacity than just, a post-credit cameo, and getting to see his eccentricness, if that's a word.
Mm-hmm.
But really, basically, this is where the Guardians realize that they need to be heroes in a sense, like keep this away from people with malintentions.
Right.
Whereas, they were just looking before just to, make a quick buck, essentially. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought this was an interesting scene. I thought it was cool to kind of really just see the awesome power of this thing inside an orb.
Yeah.
And they really had no idea what it was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, obviously the ether we get, sort of after the fact, we learned that it is kind of an Infinity Stone. But yeah, this one really highlights the whole Infinity Stone aspect. And I mean, it really drives home the importance of them. I think from this part of the from this movie going on till really Infinity War and Endgame is where the Infinity Stones become very prominent. And we, as the audience, start paying attention more to where the Infinity Stones are, what they are. And I remember there was that whole, all of the sort of speculation going on what else could be an Infinity Stone, or what else are we going to see, or when are we going to see Infinity Stones and stuff like that. And I think also what's really funny outside of this, again, the sort of, I guess, making of this movie is what, like, James Gunn said he came up with this in like 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
He was honestly just sort of making it up, which is kind of funny, but it worked. I mean, it's cohesive enough, and it makes sense, and it basically underpins the entire Infinity Saga of the MCU. So can't really knock his sort of, and I don't know if that speaks to James Gunn just being like a really great storyteller that he could come up with something like this in 10 minutes or something, but great stuff. Great. Yeah. I think for all the reasons you said, this is really a good foundation for understanding what the Infinity Stones are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, what I'm going to say is a great scene here is I'm going to say the whole scene of Gamora and Quill on Nowhere connecting over his Walkman.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, the whole thing of Drax and Rocket fighting each other.
Yeah.
I mean, this is another very much character moments, but this is where you learn why the Walkman is important to Peter Quill. You sort of get those tinges of romance between Gamora and Peter, which is, I think, great. Then at the same time, you get more of what is driving Rocket's angst. I mean, Rocket has been the sort of like really gristly and tough exterior, had this really gristly and tough exterior throughout the entire first act of the movie, really. And you don't really understand what's driving him, and until you get to that whole fight between him and Drax, and you see that all of, the comments and stuff that he's been getting about, him being vermin or him being a rodent or something like that, they all affect him. And whether he likes to show it or not, like, that it does really affect him. And he's dealing with his own sort of demons. And I think that really, despite all of like the, it's that sort of balance that James Gunn really does really well, where he has these sort of more intimate and personal moments between like Peter and Gamora. And then it's cut by something that's tinged with like a little bit more sadness and more seriousness. But yeah, you get a sense of really everyone's characters then. And even as Peter and Gamora are almost flirting in a way, she she doesn't let her guard go down, really. Just she's always has this guard up about her, just because she doesn't think that she thinks that Peter is trying to like seduce her, or like trying to like get some advantage over her or something like that. And it also speaks to the nature that everyone is still here out of self-interest. Like, they're not really here out of, trying to help out each other. They're really here just to try and, get the 4 billion units from the collector. But yeah, any thoughts on this scene, Chris?
No, I agree with everything you're saying. And I think just another layer to the Gamora piece is like, yeah, it shows that she's here for her self-interest and can't let her guard down, but I think it's also a reflection of her upbringing as well.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing who her father is.
Oh, yeah.
So, and you know, I think that whole relationship is done really well in this movie. Well, maybe, I guess we see more of the relationship between Nebula and Thanos, but we still get a sense that Gamora is heavily favored, even though we may not necessarily see it as much.
Yeah.
I feel like that presence, or at least that sort of favoritism, is definitely felt.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, he gives the whole speech to Ronan where he says, you even alienated my favorite daughter, Gamora. Like, he says it outright. So, no, but yeah, I mean, you can tell that, like, she is begrudgingly the first, the favorite child at this point. Like, she is not as enamored with Thanos. And, I mean, she's literally trying to get this money to try and hide from him and, like, get away and not be discovered by him anymore. So,
yeah,
clearly there is some deep-seated trauma there that is motivating her to get this money to get away from him and from Ronan, really. But, I mean, everyone really has that sort of driving, I guess, trauma in a way that is that makes their characters, I think, what they are. I mean, like, Drax has his family being killed. Gamora has her whole past of her entire being stolen from her entire race, and Thanos abducting her, basically, and then Peter having his mom thing, and then Rocket having all the stuff that happens, which we learn later on about the High Evolutionary and stuff. But it's just everyone has these things that are really driving their characters and gives them a really strong foundation for us. I mean, it makes them a lot more complex than just being, you know, and then the sort of exterior that they present for themselves, which I think the characterizations in this movie are so good. I mean, they're just great. Keep going on and on about them. But yeah, how about, I'll pass it back to you, Chris. Another good scene from Act Two.
Probably towards the end of Act Two, where Peter goes to save Gamora. He has a decision, and he decides to go save Gamora, and basically turning himself in to the Ravagers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have the character development and character moment again, where Quill, beginning of film, without hesitation, would probably just leave Gamora.
Yeah.
And keep the orb. But now we see him sort of develop into this character who's more open to caring and wants to save a life of this person who he's literally known for, I don't know, maybe a few days tops.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I just felt like that was a great character moment. And further seeds this romance that we will see, like you mentioned before, that we'll see later on, you know, throughout the franchise, throughout the MCU.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a great scene. I mean, I think this scene, or even the setup to the scene, again, just shows how Gunn, he does setups really well. Like, I mean, the fact that we had the whole setup of the, you know, Gamora, Peter, Rocket, and Groot all fighting on Xandar. Even here, we have a great setup of Ronan, the Ravagers, and Yondu all fighting, and then them also trying to escape at the same time. Like, there's that whole setup of the, and obviously this being after the whole explosion that happens in the Collector's sort of, I guess, showroom, if you want to call it that, as when all of the Power Stone basically destroys it. But it's just such a great scene overall, just because, yeah, I mean, I agree. It really does show, I mean, by the end of the whole Collector scene, you see a shift in Gamora and Peter's character where they are more willing to be, they recognize that this is beyond them and they have to do something here for the greater good. Kind of. I mean, Peter does also say that we could also, you know, sell it to someone that isn't going to use it to do evil. But I think he recognizes at some level that he has to, this can't fall in the hands of Ronan or Thanos, because he realizes that there is something much bigger at play here.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's I think the start of it. And then of course, and part of that, and that leads into the scene at the end, which you're talking about, where Peter does act more altruistically and actually saves Gamora versus, you know, Drax is still acting very selfishly in the scene. He calls Ronan single-handedly to try and take him on.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was I mean, it's kind of funny, but it is also kind of sad that, like, he basically gets just trounced by Ronan. And Ronan doesn't even care about him. Like, Ronan's like, I don't remember you. I don't remember your family. Like, he's walking away from Drax as he is trying to fight him, which, I mean, Drax takes, obviously, like, he's like, man, you can't even face me. Like, I'm not even worth anything to you that you don't even want to, you don't even want to fight me here. And then, of course, Rocket and Groot are, I guess Rocket in particular, he's very quick to want to just, like, you know, leave them. He doesn't think that it's worth saving them or fighting them. But, like, by the end of the scene, when they get taken by the Ravagers, he's not maybe acting in self-interest anymore, but he does want to save at least Peter and Gamora, which goes to show that they've really endeared themselves to one another and become friends. But just a great, like, every scene, even any action scene here, is just a way to sort of further develop the characters. I mean, we keep saying it, but, like, James Gunn really just does such a good job at making every scene feel meaningful. And it's not just there for the visual element of, like, oh, we're having a fight now, or we're having more raising your adrenaline here, but it actually serves a purpose in the broader story, which is just great. I mean, it's a great scene too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anything else you want to add there, Chris?
I will say, I feel like we haven't talked, I mean, this is not necessarily a scene, but I feel like we just haven't talked enough about Nebula. And
yes,
I do think she has one of the greatest character arcs in the MCU currently.
Oh yeah. No, definitely. Yeah.
And this is the only film where we really see her as an antagonist or villain for the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
And just also another thing, as we get through these MCU movies with Nebula, we start to see her become more human.
Oh, yeah.
In a sense, like, personality wise, but also you'll notice in this movie, her voice has that sort of very robotic echo to her, reverb. And then, I don't know, in the later movies, that roboticness, that effect is played down significantly.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even notice that, but yeah, that's a good call. I thinking about it, you're right. It does definitely come into play there. Yeah.
So I don't know if that was intentional to kind of show this humanization of Nebula, but it works. So that's just my final 2 cents on this topic, I guess.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I mean, you mentioned the whole Gamora thing. I mean, we haven't really talked about this, but, and I guess we didn't really talk about it. Was this in Act 1 or Act 2? I think it was in Act 1, really, where this is the first time we really get, like, a sense of who Thanos is also. We didn't really talk about it, but, you know, before we just had him in the Avengers, like, just turn around and give us a smile, a coy smile. But in this movie, like, we actually get a sense of who he is. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I've seen in, like, some of these other, and, like, I guess non-MCU movies as well, is, like, the whole idea of a king isn't someone that, like, acts like a king, but it's someone that, like, everyone else acts like he's a king just because of like, their actions. And you can tell, like, right away, that there's this level of, like, fear and respect that everyone has for Thanos, which I guess comparing him to what we're dealing with now with Kang the Conqueror is very different. I mean, the only person that really treats Kang like a serious threat nowadays is Loki. But in this movie, in the MCU, like, phase one, everyone treats Thanos like he is, like, do not mess with Thanos, do not cross him, do not get on his wrong side. And really establishes him as a serious threat. And I say this not, like, completely devoid from what you just said, not removed from that, because I'm saying that because the fear that Thanos has instilled in everyone, it's magnified so much further between Gamora and Nebula. And I mean, that's really driving Gamora's fear of him and, like, wanting to get away. And it's also driving Nebula's fear in, like, wanting to try and please her dad. Because Gamora's really been sort of the apple of his eye for so long.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just, I mean, yeah, Nebula does have a great character arc. You definitely are a good call there. You know, we haven't really also talked about Ronan all that much.
There's a reason.
There is a reason. I will say, I don't think Ronan wasn't a great villain by himself, but I think he was an intimidating villain. I don't know if that makes sense. Like he is scary in terms of his actions, but he isn't a great villain in terms of like motivation. If I don't know if you agree with that or if you feel like he was just sort of bad all around.
Well, I haven't really thought about it that way. So I think your point makes sense. Mm-hmm. I do agree. Like I thought the motivation was weak. The motivation really being like, oh, I have a feud with these people.
Yeah.
Let's go destroy this planet.
Yeah.
That's really about it.
That's basically it. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, he doesn't, I mean, this is, I think, that sort of standard MCU failing for a lot of their movies, I guess, till honestly, to like middle of phase three, where in service of trying to really focus on the main characters and developing them, which they do a good job of, the villain really does take a backseat here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, understand why, but yeah, Ronan, not that well developed. And I was saying that his actions are maybe more intimidating just because, mm-hmm. and this is maybe a bit more in Act 3, so I'll jump the gun here, but is like the fact that he is without hesitation when he's not able to get the Dark Aster down is literally willing to kamikaze his own people into Xandar to try and instill fear. And I think that that's, you know, pretty brutal. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we've been going back and forth, but I think I guess a last scene here for Act Two, which I have to mention, is the, where they're sitting in a round table after they are saved by mm-hmm. the Ravagers, the whole scene, which really sort of cements them as guardians. The whole scene of basically Peter saying that it's time for us to give a shit. And I mean, this is, I think, really the culmination of all of the sort of actions that they've taken. Like, I mean, Drax realizing that he can't fight Ronan on his own, that he has to work as a team. Gamora realizing that, you know, they have to work as a team in order to stop stop Ronan and get back the Power Stone. Peter obviously is the one sort of driving that whole discussion. Groot is, you know, there along for the ride, but like Rocket obviously takes a bit of convincing, and it's this sort of roundtable, or I guess this discussion between all of them, that really makes him sort of support the whole idea here. Mm-hmm. And it really does complete, it doesn't complete the hero's arc, but it really cements them as actually trying to be heroes here, which yes. I think really works for, I mean, they go from being sort of anti-heroes to actually sort of being heroes here. And that mm-hmm. really is, it's great. And also, you know, I was mentioning some of the subcontext before, like the sort of meta text here is the whole idea of how James Gunn, this whole scene about it's time for us to give a shit is really James Gunn talking to himself, where his whole sort of, I guess, filmography and work that he's done in the past, where he's had this sort of irreverent and carefree nature about the work that he's done. And this scene is very much him saying to himself is like, it's time to start giving a shit about what I do and what I really care about. And
I don't know. Scooby-Doo was kind of a banger.
Scooby-Doo was a banger. I'm not going to lie. Scooby-Doo was a banger, but he still had that very much sort of like punk, like very subversive sort of mentality. Not to say that he's not subversive here, but he definitely had a lot more of an edge to him, which is, you know, part of the reason why his past Twitter comments were maybe less than savory.
But yeah.
Yeah. Like I think Guardians is really where, as a filmmaker, he levels up beyond the context of the MCU as focusing on things that really matter. And like, and he becomes and people take him a lot more seriously now, James Gunn, as a, mm-hmm. as an individual versus he wasn't really known as a quantity before. He was very much a small time indie filmmaker. So
yep.
Yeah, I mean, I've been going on about this one. Chris, what do you think about this whole scene?
I agree. Like, this is, like you said, this really cements them as the Guardians. It mm-hmm. really shows their transition from anti-hero to heroes.
Yeah.
It's got some comedy, but also got some heart to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a great scene.
Yeah.
It was necessary. And, you know, it's part of the hero's journey. So
yeah. Absolutely.
I thought it was a really great scene. Had a, like I said, a good balance between comedy and seriousness. And it's a nice transition to, okay, let's go and save Xandar.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you're right. It really does, again, balance all of the tones that we see in this movie. It has an element of somberness to it. It has an element of fun to it. I mean, like the whole thing of them making fun of Peter having only 12% of a plan. Mm-hmm. And then there's also like an element of, you know, genuine heartfelt emotion there where he is recognizing that everyone is coming at this from a different place, where like Drax is coming at it from his family being lost and everyone really has, you know, skeletons in their closet that they're dealing with here. But yeah, it's just such a great scene. It's such a great scene. I mean, we could keep going on and on about how much we like this scene. But yeah, that's all the scenes that I really had in mind here for Act 2, Chris. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to talk about.
No, let's keep it moving and we'll head over to trivia.
Yeah, I guess we'll head over to trivia, which still regretting that we didn't swap these for some reason.
Yeah. But, you know,
honestly, you know, thinking about it, it probably works for the best because you and I probably each know these movies so well. So it probably makes sense that we ask the other person about it.
All right.
But yeah, we are going to do trivia now because I asked the questions last week. Chris, you will be asking the questions to me this week.
Yes. All right. So the first question. So why was Drax's skin tone changed to gray opposed to his comic color of green?
Oh, wow. Wow. I didn't even think about this. You're right. He is green in the comics and he's not green here. It's probably something stupid. It's probably like the Hulk is green and they didn't want another muscly green dude in the MCU. That's my guess.
That is correct.
Let's go. Wow. I mean,
what a guess.
It does make sense. I mean, like, I like you don't want to, you know, get people confused up there. But yeah, wow.
Yeah. You know, and like, I guess they also
won't be green either coming into Fantastic Four.
Yeah. But yeah, they also have Gamora and this who's green, but the main thing was to differentiate from the Hulk. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, you know, very different from the Hulk, but yeah, I guess, you know, differentiating from the Hulk. Yep.
Yep. All right. So one for one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, what is the name of the raccoon that they use to model Rocket?
Oh, okay. Well, there's no chance I know this one.
It's a famous raccoon.
The famous raccoon. I didn't even know there were famous raccoons.
Yeah, the raccoon actor. It was huge news when this raccoon passed away.
It was huge news. I don't know what news you're reading here, buddy. I don't know. I don't know what this raccoon's name was. I'm gonna say Oscar because like Oscar the Grouch lives in a trash can. Oscar the raccoon. I'm gonna say Oscar is his name.
You did have the first letter correct, but it is not Oscar. It is Oreo.
No, well, you know, color wise, that makes sense. I did not know that. I don't know what news you're reading. I did not hear about the name of this raccoon.
I'm surprised. Like they had it, the raccoon at like these premieres as well.
Okay, clearly I was not paying attention to the premieres. I mean, like, did he pass away after Guardians 3 or before Guardians 3?
Before Guardians 3.
Okay,
like, I think like just before like 2020.
Got it. Okay. Peaced out right before the pandemic. All right. I did not know this name. That was, you know, you stumped me there.
Had to get, you know, some obscure trivia for you.
Yep. All right.
All right. Number three. What are the first and last songs on the film soundtrack Awesome Mix Volume 1?
All right. Well, the first one has to be Come and Get Your Love by Redbone. And then the last one, is it I Want You Back by Jackson 5, like it is in the movie?
Both are incorrect.
Really?
Number one, Hooked on a Feeling.
Oh, damn. Okay, that makes sense.
The last song, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. So the last song in the, it is the last song in the movie, but not the post credit.
I mean, no, it's not the last song in the movie, because as they fly away, they're doing the...
Ain't No Mountain High Enough?
Is it? Oh, it is. You're right. It is Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Yeah. Okay. I mixed that up. Damn.
But yeah. So yeah, they happen to line that one up for being the last one on the soundtrack. But yeah, Hooked on the Feeling.
Hooked on the Feeling.
Probably all the right. biggest song on the... Yeah.
On the album, yeah. And I mean, we didn't mention it, but... no, we did mention it in the beginning. Great soundtrack through and through. Yeah. Great soundtrack. Anyway. Damn. That's a shame. And it's what's even more of a shame is I actually had the soundtrack digitally, so I've heard the soundtrack a lot, so I feel extra stupid for not getting that.
All right, moving on to number four.
Yeah.
Laura Haddock appears in this film as Peter Quill's mother. And what other MCU film did she appear in, but in a different role?
Okay, well, this I know. She appears in Cap 1. She's correct. The girl that's like trying to woo Steve.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And she succeeds temporarily.
She does. She does.
And then finally, which actor who also starred on a hit comedy show like Chris Pratt did with Parks and Rec was the runner-up choice to play Star-Lord?
He was also on Parks and Rec?
No, no, no. He was on a hit comedy show similar to how
Chris Pratt was on a hit comedy show. Yeah. Jeez. Oh my God. I do not know this one either. You really, I mean, you pick some good questions. I'm like between like John Krasinski here and who's the other one? What's his name? Andy Samberg. Like, I'm trying to think who are other main like comedy like guys. I'm going to say John Krasinski. That's my guess.
That is incorrect, but I'm sure you're aware of the other role that Krasinski was in the running for.
Yeah, he was in the running for Cap, of course.
Correct. This would be none other than Dennis Reynolds.
Really?
Glenn Howerton from Always Sunny.
I did not. Wow. I didn't even know that he. Wow. I cannot see anyone from It's Always Sunny being in a superhero movie. Maybe.
DeVito?
Oh, I mean, Danny DeVito, of course, he would be the most iconic Wolverine of them all, but. Or Spider-Man, but.
I mean, he's already been in one. Been in a superhero movie.
Right, right, right. I mean, of course, he played the Penguin, but I couldn't. I guess I can't see the other cast. The other can't cast that's not been in one. Rob, Quackley. I could see him maybe popping up in Deadpool 3 just because of his relationship now with Ryan Reynolds. But yeah, wow. I didn't that one actually caught me by surprise. I did not think that that was an actual thing. Wow.
Yeah, neither did I until I was trying to find some trivia for this.
Wow. Well, there you go. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we'll see Glenn Howerton pop up again in the MCU. But that is actually very surprising to me that he was even in the running for this.
Yeah,
you know, me too. He would have actually been better as the, what's his name? Adam Warlock, you know, Golden God and all.
Oh, yeah. that fits.
It does fit, exactly. Yeah. But all right, yeah, well, here we go. That was a very bad trivia round for me.
Chris. Solid two.
Solid. I mean, that's one way to put it. 2 out of 5 there. But yeah, trivia got kind of demolished there. But, you know, Good run on you. Good questions, for sure.
Thank you. Thank you.
But yeah, we'll just jump right into Act 3. And I will say, there's not much to Act 3 other than the final action sequence, really. Do you have anything you want to discuss here, Chris? Any major scenes?
Yeah, I think there are two major scenes, for me at least. One is going to be the ship, or the Dark Aster, going down.
Yes.
With Groot sacrificing himself.
Yeah, that is a scene, yep.
You know, encasing all the Guardians in himself and, you know, saying we are Groot for the only, you know, non-I am Groot line. Yeah. So that was a very emotional one. And you see really how much Rocket's crying about this decision.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah.
That's the first one. If we want to talk about that, and I can get to my second one afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is such a great scene. I mean, it's by this point in the movie, like, I mean, Groot has really been, he's an interesting character because he's been sort of like on the side here. He's very much like the comedic relief in the movie. But he also, like I said earlier on, he's the lovable oaf here where he like is just sort of going along, having a good time. But like he cares deeply about all of his friends here. And the fact that he, without hesitation, is willing to sacrifice himself to protect them as the Dark Aster is falling. Just, again, great scene. And of course, we are Groot, one of the most iconic, I think, lines or pieces of dialogue in the MCU overall. I mean, I remember that was like just everywhere at that time. Everyone was talking about that scene. So great scene overall. I think I have a feeling what I know your second scene is going to be, but
take a guess.
Is it the dance off?
Of course.
Yeah. Why don't you go off on the dance off? Why don't you talk about that scene?
Sure. So I guess it's happens basically right after.
Yes.
Groot sacrifices himself where they crash land into Xandar. And I think it's, again, really great way of incorporating comedy into here, where Ronan is about to, he's given his monologue, is about to destroy Xandar with his Warhammer that has the Power Stone in it. And Star-Lord, serves as a distraction, with a dance off to save the universe.
Yep.
A la Footloose.
Yes, a la Kevin Bacon. He does become Kevin Bacon in this scene, yes. Which they see it a lot of times. I mean, we also didn't talk about this really all that much, but like all of the 70s references that he makes is just like really great. 70s, 80s references. Yeah, just it is a great scene. It establishes, again, Peter's character as finding the levity in things. But it's also just such a great way of like subverting expectations. Like it's not like they're just to like be goofy and be funny, but it actually serves a purpose that he's trying to, distract Ronan. And I'll say, after the scene, the one right after is when they're actually gripping, when he's gripping the Power Stone and trying to, deal with its power. Again, it very much like, a visual scene, like the music is swelling. Obviously, I think this is really like one of the strongest sort of musical moments in the entire movie where you're hearing it. Is one, all the Guardians coming together to basically deal with the power of the stone. But at the same time, it's also like James Gunn really smartly layers in the whole thing with like his mom taking his hand or taking her hand, which he didn't do in the beginning. And he does in this one where that whole the whole arc of Peter really being that he felt alone in the beginning of the movie and was trying to sort of do things on his own. And now he very much has accepted the fact that he's part of a team and part of a whole here, taking Gamora's hand. It's another great scene, which could have just been, sort of visual noise, but it really gets cemented by the fact that it's cemented by, a great character moment here overall.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, I mean, it's just a lot of fighting here. I mean, the fight scenes are very good, I will say. Like on the Dark Aster, the fight's really good. Yondu, we finally get to see Yondu's little red arrow. I don't know if it has a name? I'm sure it does.
I think it's the Yaka arrow or something like that.
Yaka arrow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, arrow.
I could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that arrow of his also, we finally get to see what it does properly. Like we get little teases of it, but we get to see why it's actually so formidable and powerful, which is great. But yeah, any other things in this scene to talk about, Chris?
Not really. I think, like you said, just, like most Act 3s, a big fight.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we get to see Gamora try to save Nebula, or at least reach out a hand, and Nebula basically rejects it and goes off on her own. And I guess, it wraps up. We get the little tease from Yondu about Peter's father as the Ravagers are leaving Xandar, as well as the tease from Glenn Close's character, Nova Prime, that Peter's lineage is something that is way beyond their records.
Yes. Yeah. So, and it's a good setup, right? It's a good setup right there because, you're wondering like how, I mean, someone like Karina, she basically gets destroyed by just touching the stone. Somehow Peter didn't. And you're wondering why. So I'm glad they didn't leave that, up in the air for so long, because that might have been like something that might not have sat well with the fans. So, and they resolve that also in an interesting way. I don't think anyone was really expecting who Peter's father was when we, who we ultimately find out in Volume 2.
Yeah. And then I think I have to mention John C. Reilly. I think I thought his character was fun. It was a good character. It was enough of John C. Reilly where he wasn't necessarily dominating the screen as, a pretty prominent, at least 2000s, late 2000s, maybe early 2010s comedy actor. Mm-hmm, but I thought it was a nice addition. I think he played the role well, and you kind of see some of the, back and forth jabs that him and the Guardians have throughout the movie, but now at the end where they kind of reconcile. We still kind of see that back and forth between them.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, he has this really minor character, but he does a good job sort of fleshing it out there as Daenerys Day. He's just, Yeah, I wish John C. Reilly was in more things, man. I mean, he was so good in the movies that he was in back in the day. I mean, Step Brothers obviously being a key one, but
I just love the line where like he's talking about getting a message from Peter Quill.
Oh yeah,
and then you know they all the Nova Corps show up, and Peter's like, "They got my message."
Yeah, they got his dick message. Yeah. He plays it so earnestly, also, which I think makes it so, you know, funny. Where he's trying to just be like a good, I guess like a police guy almost, or like Nova Corps officer.
Yeah.
And in doing so, he like has to deal with their more unsavory language, basically. So yeah. It's great. I mean, he is a great character in there, a great little side character there. Honestly, all the Nova Corps is really interesting. It's a shame that we never got more of them. I suspect that we might if they ever end up doing like a Nova show or like a Nova movie or something, just because we really only ever saw them.
They kind of got wiped out in Infinity War.
Yeah, exactly. But we never even saw Xandar getting wiped out. So I have a feeling.
Yeah, I wish we did. Yeah.
I have a very strong feeling that we're going to get like sort of like a Krypton getting destroyed moment. But like in this case, they send out Nova as their hero to sort of escape all of that. But yeah. Bit of a shame we never saw that. Yeah. You know, another officer that we didn't mention is Peter Serafinowicz in this movie too.
Yes.
He plays the other
Darth Maul.
Yeah, Darth Maul himself. You know, he was only Darth Maul for a movie, but you know, we only get a few moments of him, but he's also a great little just side character. Him,
yes.
Glenn Close, John C. Reilly, all really great like sort of side additions within the Nova Corps overall.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, beyond that, I mean, there's really just the post-credit scenes, I think, unless you have any other main scenes you want to talk about here.
No.
No? Yeah, I mean, the post-credit scenes are obviously also, I mean, one of them is more iconic than the other, I would say, of Groot dancing in his pot. It's just a great little cute scene with baby Groot there. And then the other one, of course, being Howard the Duck in the wreckage of...
And Cosmo.
And Cosmo, of course, yeah. Cosmo we saw even earlier. But yeah, Howard the Duck there, who ends up being a not insignificant MCU character. Like, he does pop up in every other Guardians movie later on. And he does help at the Battle of Earth, you know, or the Battle of the Galaxy or whatever.
That he does.
But I think, yeah, that's Guardians of the Galaxy, Chris. I have a feeling this one's going to get a pretty strong score from you.
It is. So, not to say, you know, that our scoring ranking indicates if, you know, movies are perfect or not, but you know I have to give this a 5.
Yeah, I figured.
I won't say it's a perfect film, but, you know, there's nothing in between our 4.75 and a 5. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lean closer to the 5, so I'll round up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. You know, I think I will also give this one a 5 as well. Back-to-back 5s for me.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, this movie really does have it all. It's really hard to find faults with this movie. Just
the villain.
The villain is what it is. But like, the villain isn't even important, which is why I'm not so upset about Ronan being as underdeveloped. Obviously, I think as we go into the Guardians movies, that's, I think, something that James Gunn worked on, because the villains in the next two movies are a lot more developed and interesting. But great movie overall. Just I really hard to find faults with it. I mean, I think between this and Cap 2, the MCU really does hit its stride here and really cemented itself between the two. I mean, the fact that Cap 2 was like a genre film, very different from the sort of standard superhero fare. And then this is like a complete swing out of left field for Marvel. I think it really cemented that they could do no wrong, really. And they were just really at the top of their game. And it really set them up in a strong place going into Avengers Age of Ultron, which is our next episode, of course. But yeah, I guess any final thoughts here, Chris, before we wrap up?
Great movie.
Yes,
would recommend to everybody, like I mentioned.
Yeah, it's a small indie movie, guys. Yeah, I mean, if you guys haven't seen it, firstly, what are you doing? It's the end of the podcast. We've spoiled this entire movie for you. But yes. Please do watch this movie or watch it again. You know, we're assuming that you have seen it if you're listening to this podcast. But yeah, great movie. And I think a great discussion here, Chris, for Guardians 1. And yeah, But I think beyond that, should we wrap it up here, Chris?
Yep, let's send it home.
Yeah, so of course, we are the Asha Shekni podcast. If you like what you listened to here today, please be sure to like, rate, and subscribe to our podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, Pocket Cast, wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any further questions or would like to continue the conversation, you can find us at our email address, which is ostrichtechnique@gmail.com. Any feedback, any comments you have about this episode, do please send it to us. We do check our email. We haven't got any, you know, emails from people, but, you know, do please reach out to us there. And yeah, we'll be back on our next episode with Avengers Age of Ultron, another supersized episode. But I guess until then, I've been Anunth.
And I've been Chris.
And we'll see you guys our next episode. Bye.
Thanks.